Hey, HG 101 fans, I want you to know that we're crowdfunding a brand new, gorgeously printed hardcover book covering 101 weird, obscure, historically important, and just plain cool Japanese video games. It's going to be called Hardcore Gaming 101 Presents Japanese Video Game Obscurities, but we can only put it out with your pledge. So check out hardcoregaming101.net. The link should be pretty much close to the top of the page. Japanese Video Game Obscurities. This is, if we get to do this, it's going to be our best looking book yet, and it's one of those books that it'll be about stuff you've probably never heard of. In fact, I can almost guarantee you won't have heard of almost all of it. So give a hoot, fund our book, $15 for the PDF, $20 plus shipping for the hardcover. Do it!
Hello and welcome to episode 80 of HardcoreGaming101.net's top 47,858 games of all time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and this still remains true. Who picked our worst game? It was probably you. My panelists today are...
I'm Bobinator.
The Gunholt.
And I'm Discord Inc.
Welcome back, Discord.
Thanks for having me back.
Podcast, we have three rules. Rule number one, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule number two, you can nominate one game at a time via five-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. Rule number three, you can nominate games that have already been nominated, just don't nominate games that have already been ranked. You can see the master list for yourself at bit.ly/47kgames. bit.ly/47kgames? bit.ly/47kgames. First game we're talking about for this episode is Banjo-Kazooie, which was nominated by Sonic Blast Yoshi on iTunes. It was developed by Rareware and published by Nintendo for the Nintendo 64. Earliest release date and territory appears to be June 29th, 1998 in the United States. So, yeah, this is an interesting one because I think this is one of those games where we kind of have to set, like, draw like a line in the sand and find out where everybody stands on this one so the listeners aren't confused.
I have heard a lot of people lately say they're not super fond of this game, and I admit I can kind of maybe in places see where they're coming
from. So you're basically a fan, though, right?
I do enjoy the game. I think it is a good
game. What about
you,
Discord?
Yes.
I'm a big fan of it. I don't know if we went into detail, but like this is definitely a title I owned originally on the N64. I played a ton with my brothers back in the day.
Gunhart, what about you?
Major fan of it.
Really? Okay, so I am seriously outnumbered. All right.
Unfortunately, Cal was going to help balance it out, but he's not available at the moment. So,
man, that is like one of the rare events of like, that would have been a rare instance of me and Cal agreeing from the outset. That almost never happens. Now, my next question is, how old were all you guys when this game was released or when you first played it?
Let's see, you said...
I want to say... Go ahead.
You said 1998, so I would have been... 14 when this game first came out.
I want to say maybe eight because I remember for certain I got the special N64 that came with Donkey Kong 64, and that was like 99, so it had to be after that.
I got to the launch back in 98.
Yeah, so I was a bit older than that, and that I think has
and the last time I played it was in 2007 with Xbox 360 port.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I think that explains a little bit. I was a sight older than y'all. Let's see, 1998. Yeah, well, not that much. I would have been what, 16, I think. So 16, 17. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's that now 14 is pretty close, but
right.
I mean, at this point, like 1998, like I remember playing this game and I felt like I had seen this before, you know. Because as everybody knows, I'm a big fan of Super Mario 64. Do not see like I recognize that people say that that game has its flaws and it hasn't necessarily aged that well. I just don't see it. So, but then again, go ahead.
I think this game is pretty different from Mario 64 in a few ways. Don't mind if I get into that.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to introduce it.
First and foremost, I think the fact that it's similar to Mario 64 should be taken with the context that there had been only 2 years since Mario 64's release when this came out. And while there were many attempts to copy Mario 64, not many could actually be called successful at it. So already
that is definitely
that's one
true.
Thing in Banjo's favor mm-hmm. is that it was a highly polished, great-looking, the 3D platformer.
I'm just going to say something crazy here real quick. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say that I think, honestly, this game is more influential than Mario 64. Hear me out.
Okay, I'll listen.
I was wondering who was going to come up first.
A lot of people have ripped off Banjo-Kazooie. No one has tried to do Mario 64 except Nintendo.
No, but the Banjo-Kazooie tried to do Mario 64.
They're pretty different games to get into it.
But the play style is the same. You're going like you start out in like basically a castle, and you go and collect the Jiggy Jaggies or whatever they are, and then you go into the different worlds, and then you collect more Jiggy Jaggies and other stuff inside the worlds. I mean, it is
but it's kind of like the similarity between Doom and Wolfenstein, really.
Into a tangent here?
Yeah, okay.
A long while back when we were discussing Mario 64, I said that there were basically like two schools to making 3D platformers. You can make it like a playground. That's basically what Mario 64 is. You go from point A to point B, but the game doesn't really care how you do it. This game is more like a theme park. It's very structured. It kind of tells you what to do and kind of where to go. And the focus is more on checking out all the cool set pieces, really, I would say.
It does have a lot more of those than Mario 64, but Mario 64 had that stuff.
Actually, to me, the thing about Banjo-Kazooie that differentiates it is that its levels are a little bit more like a sandbox. Mario had sort of a mix of sandbox levels and these more linear platform challenge levels. Like, there's a huge difference between Bomb Battlefield and Rainbow Ride. While Banjo-Kazooie's typically drop you off at a starting point and then let you explore them however you want from start to finish.
Yeah, especially the sandbox really comes through with how... did I get disconnected?
I mean, there's not even really a clear start and finish, right? It's just kind of... There's like a world, and you just do the stuff that there is to do in that world. And that's a lot of collecting stuff. So, just for fun, let's name all the stuff you can collect in each level.
Actually, first, I'd like to point out that I think one of the few games I would really consider to be more akin to Mario 64 would have been the first Sly Cooper game, in that its levels were... Okay, well, each level had only one goal. It had kind of that linear structure that Mario 64 had.
Sly Cooper felt more like Crash Bandicoot to me, but I think we're getting off track somewhere.
Okay, but yeah, naming collectibles in there. You have like the notes, which are kind of kind of like Mario's coins.
Basically, like the coin.
Yeah,
they're like the coins in Mario 64.
Yeah,
they serve the same purpose.
Yeah, they do unlock gates throughout like the overworld hub.
Note gate.
That's the main thing. Yeah. Then there's Jiggies, which are stars.
Jiggy Jaggies, we got those. Jiggy Ziggies.
You've got the Mumbo skulls that you need to give to the local witch doctor to
get the Mumbo skulls. You got those weird little like pointy-nosed gremlins that you collect?
Jinjos. Which I actually can't remember what those were for except for the final battle.
You collect five of them and you get a Jiggy in each stage.
Oh, yeah.
So they're like the red coins.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly like the red coins.
You've got honeycombs to give you health upgrades. Mm-hmm. You've got extra lives.
Yeah, but those aren't like mandatory like collectibles. So I can give those a break. They're kind of they're like the other. It's like they split the coin function up from in Mario 64. The coins were both your health and a like collectible thing that you know if you wanted to get all the stars, you could get 100 coins in each stage.
I think those are referring to the ones that actually extended your health gauge.
Yeah, there's honeycombs. The honeycombs extend your health gauge. The notes do not. That's what I'm saying.
No, I mean, I think you've got this mixed up. There were honeycomb pieces that restored your health, and then there were. Empty honeycombs. That
what he means is stuff you absolutely have to collect to progress, and there's less of that, I would say. It's not as bad as people have said it is.
Well, we've already named four things, and what are the empty honeycombs mandatory?
No,
or like,
not really, no.
But do they do anything other than like you collect these and you get stuff?
They increase your health gauge.
Okay, so that's at least a meaningful collection. Mm. I mean, I guess they're all kind of meaningful. They all do something, but that's like a collected, like, you know, there's one in each world. Is that it? Or no?
I think, like,
there's only
two,
one in some of the worlds.
I think there's like two in each world, if memory serves me correct.
What else is there? There's...
I think that's all. Where I think like the numbers really go up is the fact that you have like so much different ammunition you got to keep track of. These aren't required, but you have like red feathers for flying, you have gold feathers for invisibility, and blue eggs for ammunition because you can shoot eggs.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of managing all that can kind of is what really kind of makes it overwhelming. Like, none of them are required, but there's just a lot of them around. And it feeds into that compulsion of, oh, I got to grab everything.
And there's like, So it's not quite the collectathon that it's cracked up to be, is what I'm hearing you guys say. Although that does sound like a lot of things to collect.
Well, I mean, it's not really all that different from how, like, we just established Moyo had three different things, it had two alternate ways to acquire all stars.
Yeah, I mean, it had the stars, which you could get in a variety of ways.
Then you
could
get 100 coins, and coins. Then add five.
Yeah, and then the five red coins.
So it's really not all that different.
Like, it's streamlined, though. Like, you hear what I'm saying? Like, there's, like, you're not, like, getting honeycombs and then music notes and then... It's like, it's just coins. And to the point where Mario 64 actually, like in this game, you go underwater and it gives you a separate honeycomb gauge for your oxygen. And you get a nice, cool, you know, its drowning animation is almost as good as Mario 64's. And I won't lie. It's pretty good. It doesn't have the disturbing sound effect where he's going, go, 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 go. But I mean, just imagine Banjo doing that. Being, go, 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 go. But it has like a separate gauge for that. And that just, to me, that's like almost a synecdoche of the entire...
You mean so you can't just stay near the surface to...
Yeah, exactly, which is something that Mario 64 did on purpose. Like, I think that is a very streamlined game, even with the three collectible things. But it's still like, it does really focus on the stars, because even if you're collecting the five coins, red coins, or getting the 100 coins, that just gets you another star. And that's really all it is, so... You know, like, it's not like you're like, oh, go revisit each level to make sure that you're catching like the Jiggy Jaggy and then getting the pointy nosed dwarfs and getting the silver skulls. I mean, it's a world apart in that respect. So now that's not necessarily a bad thing, because if it's a bad thing, then almost like every like Assassin's Creed game is guilty of this, as well as like, you know, other, you know, well-regarded games that they still do this stuff as a way of adding depth or replay value or length or whatever you want to call it. I probably wouldn't call it depth, but replay value or length or something.
It's the illusion of depth that it's adding.
There's another thing I feel is kind of related to this issue we could talk about. You have to find a bunch of different moves in this game, and there are a lot of them, and they can kind of vary on how useful they actually are.
It's cool, though, because sometimes... Like, it's a cool feature. I think that, like, the different stuff that the different abilities you can get, or just the different abilities you use. For example, like, the very first thing I think you learn about, well, you've got a double jump, for one thing, that starts, you start out with. You've got the bird in your backpack, Kazooie, who does, like, a hover thing. And that gets longer, right? Like, you can increase the hover duration.
No.
I don't think you can.
No?
But...
Really? That seems obvious, but I guess, okay, maybe I must be confusing it with a different game.
You can get unlock the ability to fly when you go off of flight pads. That might be what you're getting confused with.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But you
the
got
thing is,
yeah. Oh, I was gonna say, like, the coolest thing it starts you out with is that you can switch who's doing the walking. So normally you're the big dumb bear with the backpack, but you can switch to be the bird, and the bear rides on your back, and you can climb up slopes, which is something that anybody who's played a 3D platformer of this era is like, I wish I could, you know, it feels empowering in a good way. Like, it's pretty
so,
cool.
My issue is that some of these powers are, like, really useful, like the ability to walk around with Kazooie. You basically want to have that all the time. And sometimes they're just really situational, and they're basically just there to get, like, a handful of jiggies and basically do nothing else, like the swamp boots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's they could have tightened this up, but I remember liking when I played it, I liked this kind of, like, you know, get new abilities and using that as like a, you know, it's like a vaguely Metroid-esque aspect to it. It's not nearly as pronounced as, say, even like some like the PS2, like Castlevania, Metroid 3D ones, but it is there, and they do something with it, and it plays pretty well. Another cool thing this game does that I think deserves credit is it's got like the slightly dynamic music, where at different parts of the level, the music will slowly change. And it's like always keeps the same melody, but it'll add different stuff to it, which is...
Yeah, that I think is probably one of the coolest things in the game, is that dynamic sound track. And I'm kind of surprised I rarely, if ever, see it used anywhere else.
It's probably harder to implement than it seems. Like, the one thing I'll say about Rare at this stage is that they were... I don't know, their games were not as great as I remembered them when I play them now, for the most part. But you always get the impression there was something that they were really proud of. We're going to try this, and we're going to do whatever it takes to make it work. And for this game, I think it was the dynamic music. I mean,
yeah. On some aspect of abilities, that is something I really appreciate about the game. So the Okay, so Moyo, I will admit, gets by this on grandfather clause, but one thing I appreciate is that the main characters actually tie into the abilities you can use. Like, to use another example, I always liked the Spyro series because all of your abilities pretty much relate to the fact that you're playing as a dragon, or in Psychonauts, where everything is about the fact that you're a psychic circus performer. Mm-hmm. So here, the fact that you are a strong animal who can punch things and a fast bird that can fly, I appreciate that your abilities all tied to
right,
that
they're not just giving you, like, here's the rocket boots, and here's the rocket pack, and here's the rocket helmet. You know, I'm not a very creative person, so all my ideas involve rockets, but...
That does kind of sum up Ratchet and Clank in a nutshell.
Yeah, but, right, so it's not just giving you a bunch of useless new guns or something like that. It's like, they're actually... They thought about what their characters were and did something with that, which means it's not like the Mickey Mouse problem, right? I think of like Mickey Mouse is a weird character because he's a mouse, but in almost no Mickey Mouse cartoon does him being a mouse factor into anything that happens. Like, he doesn't get chased by cats, he doesn't go after cheese, he doesn't live
technically
with walls.
His arch nemesis Piglet Pete is a cat. It's just really hard to tell.
I thought he was a dog.
Nope, he's a cat. They just stopped drawing his tail after the first few shorts.
I learned something today. Wow. He looks just like a dog. Okay. That is really interesting. Okay, but right, you know what I mean? Like, it's not, and this is not like a huge problem because obviously like Mickey Mouse is a popular character to this day, et cetera. Nobody cares that his being a mouse doesn't mean anything. But I do like when that, you know. And then to contrast that with Bugs Bunny, who is a rabbit and he usually lives in holes and eats carrots and is pestered by hunters. And like him being a rabbit is a big part of his identity and his, I don't want to call it skill set because it's a cartoon, but you know what I mean? And so yes. Like, and it's the same like with a character like Mario, like other than the stuff that Mario is supposed to be able to do, there's not really any like, you know, like chubby Italian-American skill set, you know? If there were, I would have it, personally. But, you know, like, so I think it's cool that they did that. It wasn't just like, oh, let's make cute animal characters for the hell of it, you know? They thought of a cool thing to do. And I do like that Kazooie lives in your backpack. I don't like his 90s habit of referring to everybody as something boy.
Kazooie's a girl.
Not in my head canon. They're lovers. I don't know. Sorry. I didn't... I probably should have known that, but I didn't. I'm sorry, Kazooie.
I just didn't know, like, that you had a headcanon about this game.
Yeah, well...
Can you share any of your fan fictions with us?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
I do like
it's all Mumbo-related, to be honest.
I don't know what you call it. I do like how they handle the voices in this game. I do find that kind of charming.
I will say with the characters, it definitely seems to be something like you really love or it just bounces off you. Because I've heard so many people that would mention the character, like the fact that all the characters talking and like they have a distinct googly-eyed look and look very Muppety as a negative point for the game and like just getting sick of it.
It's not a terribly, like there's nobody's going to look at these characters and be like, oh, yeah, that's so-and-so's work. That's, you know, this was designed at such-and-such a studio or, you know, publisher, developer, whatever. It's like, it's just generic anthropomorphic cartoon animals. And then, like, everything has eyes and talks to you. Like, the Jiggy Jaggies talk to you and the whatever talk to you. And there's a mole who's got he's got goggles on, right? And then there's the Mumbo, which is kind of an interesting, like, a more original-looking character. You got the pointy-nosed gremlins who look to me just like something out of, like, I don't know why, but they remind me of the movie Inside Out, like that character design in a weird way. But they really should.
It looks like CG animated film before the generic CG animated film before those were actually a thing.
It's an early DreamWorks joint, I think, but less extreme. Like there's less tude. And I do appreciate that like with the exception of Kazooie calling everybody like, hey, Goggles Boy or hey, Hut Boy or hey, you know, so-and-so boy. Mm-hmm. Like that was a very 90s, like,
yeah,
dumb 90s. I don't know what you call it. It's not really a trend. It's not a fad. It's just a dumb thing that people did in the 90s.
Attitude.
But like it's calling somebody like some random thing about them boy, right? Like there were these pretzel commercials with Jason Alexander and he'd like be like skydiving with pretzels and somebody go, "Hey, pretzel boy." It's like what is that? What's that mean? It's like it's the same thing as like it's I would make it akin to the prevalence of cheese as a joke in and of itself. It's not funny. there's nothing funny about cheese. But in the 90s, you just mentioned cheese, and that was a punchline. Urkel, that he made all kinds of bank off that. I guess, like, to me, like, I like one thing I like about Rare games is that I like how up to, you know, they did Conquer, Spad for a Day, and all that, which was its own thing. But I like the deliberate cuteness and family friendliness of it. I like how edgy they were not, I guess.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I didn't really get into Conqueror's Bad Fur Day when that was a thing.
To be honest, it's why I didn't really like the sequel as much, because it has a lot more of that British mean-spirited humor to it.
But, I mean, although the character designs of Banjo-Kazooie aren't great, it is a colorful, cute world, and I liked it when games were like, that was the default, it's like cute little characters. And if you had like a kick-ass game based on cute little characters, it could be really hard even, you know, it could be really cool. Like, I never thought I'd find myself saying this, but I really do. Like, it's cute little cartoon characters were like the bald space marine of the 90s, you know?
Get back to the game for a bit. One big issue I think really hurts this game is you don't just collect stuff once. If you leave a level or you die or anything like that, you got to do it all pretty much all over again. And that's
the notes, actually, just the notes
and the Jinjos. And
yeah.
But you got still
the Jinjos are the pointy Muppets.
Yes. Really annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. That sucks.
Yes.
But if you got the Jiggy from them, you don't need to care again. But yeah. Otherwise.
This was actually remedied in both of its re-releases on the Xbox consoles, with at least the notes being all kept should you lose or leave a level. But that is a huge problem on the N64 version, especially in some late game stages like Rusty Bucket Bay that include the bottomless pits.
Yeah,
and since I mentioned Rusty Bucket Bay, I also want to point out that I hate the fact that the game has two separate levels, that and Clinkle's Cavern, that Steam can best be described as water, rusty, metal.
Are you saying that there's something unappealing about that, or just that it's lazy?
It's kind of boring and not very colorful compared to the rest of the game, really.
It's just, I mean, I'd have had the same problem if it had the two, Termite's Jungle levels or two two Winter levels. It's just, given the fact that it's a much smaller number of levels compared to Mario 64, it can't really get away with recycling the deep.
True, although I do feel like the art design in this game, although I don't like the style of it that much, I mean, they put a lot of effort into like creating the different environments, and like there's kind of a little bit more. I can kind of understand how they'd be like, well, we need another level, but we don't want to create like an entirely new thing to like a, you know, like an entirely new theme that some art design person needs to go through and like create the textures for. And that, you know, that is hard work. Like somebody has to, a creative person has to come up with this stuff and implement it. Whereas with Mario 64, they didn't have that.
Actually, now that you mentioned that, I think we do need to also look at another elephant in the room with this one, is the fact that it's definitely one of those unfortunate cases where a lot of the beta elements ended up sticking in the game and thus lying to you.
Explain, I don't think I ever played the game long enough to see that.
Well, a very, very low-key one early on is go be the camel you end up having to beat up to waddle plants at different points, saying he's going to go hide in the fire world. There was a fire level in early development, and it didn't make it into the final game.
So it's like almost a graveyard duck scenario, right? Where it's like,
and then we have the entire ending, which is devoted to showing off this awesome feature for the sequel called Stop and Swap, which would let you somehow use the sequel to get items in the first game, which you would then take with you to the sequel. The problem is, this was only possible on early versions of the N64. Developer versions that held data in RAM a lot longer, and thus was impossible with the released console.
That's crappy.
So the whole ending is just basically a commercial for something that doesn't exist.
When did they start making this game? They must have started doing that back when they thought that was going to be a feature of the final console.
This game was in development for a long time. It technically started off as a Super Nintendo project with the DKC2 team.
Oh my god, really?
Yeah, it was like a much different game. I think it was more of an adventure game at that point, and had, and Banjo was only a side character in it, but they ended up promoting him to the main character when they decided to.
He was like, hey, the Hillbilly Bear needs to be in his own game. Like, this guy has, he's going places. Like,
to be honest, I always found Banjo kind of weird in that he seems like a, for lack of a better term, a bootleg version of Donkey Kong.
Donkey Kong has like a little bit more toed, I guess. Like,
but, I mean, just the basic design, the colors, the basic anatomy. I mean, he's
he is pretty top heavy, kind of like DK, right?
Yeah, he's also got the same hairless hands and feet.
Is he wearing cutoffs? He's wearing cutoffs, right?
They're like shorts, maybe. I'm not sure.
I think they're cutoffs.
Anyway, just the whole color scheme is very reminiscent of the Donkey Kong Country characters. And it was always kind of weird to me that the look was that close rather than going for something completely different.
So I guess we got to move on to ranking this one. I've tried to say as many nice things about it as I can, and now I have to do the opposite of that. So I know you guys are going to want to rank it relatively high because you have fond memories of it, and some of you, like Gunheart, is even...
I just thought that they'd escape. Yeah,
it's just a developer of Rare's talent should have made the game control better. The camera should work better. The environment should be a little bit less like big open roomy than they are. Mm. There's the number of collectibles is frankly like too many. Like they should have combined the, to me that just smacks of insecurity of like, well, this game maybe isn't big enough and we need to pad it out, because you could easily make some of those things that you collect double, you know, like, as like, say you don't have to collect like the silver skulls, you could just pay the witch doctor guy in music notes, for example, and so they function like coins and things like that. Like, it's just it seems like every time they had to make a decision about what to do with something, they were like, well, we could tighten this up and make it a more focused experience, but then the game will be too short. So, you know, there's a lot of that, and I feel like that is something that is it plagues game development to this day. It's just not necessary. I don't feel like the game controls all that well, as I said. And although the characters are cute, they're not really memorable in any real way. Even Crash Bandicoot is more memorable than Banjo.
I think the idea that you have two,
and they're almost the same design.
Okay, that's kind of harsh.
Yeah, that's harsh.
I don't know. I like the idea of like a two characters who do things together as a single unit. I think that's an interesting concept you didn't really see much of back then. I think that's worth something.
That's true. And they do something with it, as we said. Like, they do something with, especially Kazooie being a bird.
Honestly, I always found them more memorable than Ratchet and Clank, because it seems to just have more games to keep them in the public conscious.
Yeah, I mean, I am not a, like, this is kind of when I was starting to get too cool for this kind of thing. So I did not play Ratchet and Clank when it was new. And so I don't really know what to say about that. I'm just going by, like, I feel like on the one hand, like, it's a very competent game, but it's just, I mean, and because it is like one of the better, you know, 3D platformers on the N64, that's not a first party title. That is something, but I just don't know whether I would recommend anyone play this game now. Like, it just seems like there's nothing to recommend it anymore.
I would, but I wouldn't recommend it as an original form. I'd go for like either the Xbox 360 version or the Rare Replay version, since there's a bit more quality of life improvements to the game. But yeah, if you have an original Explorer and you're looking for games for library, I don't know if I could in good conscience recommend Banjo-Kazooie, unless you're like really into that style of game.
So what I'd like the three of you to do is to try to come to a consensus for yourself, or for amongst yourselves as fans, of where you think it should go, and then I'll try to argue you down, and we'll see if I'm successful. I probably won't be, but so I'll just clam up, and I just want to hear what you guys have to say about where it goes.
Is it better than Crash Bandicoot 2? That's a starting point.
I did not play Crash Bandicoot 2, so you're going to have to make that call.
Neither did I, actually.
Okay, it's also near Ape Escape and Sonic Adventure, if that helps.
Well, I would say I enjoy this more than Ape Escape.
really comparable in a strange way of like kind of in the, this kind of like does a template that some stuff works going back to it, some stuff doesn't.
But I'm not sure I'd put it above Sonic Adventure, which is just too weird than the crazier game out of it.
I think like the line I could draw here is it would not be better than Yoshi's Island.
That's fair.
For me, I think between Sonic Adventure and Ape Escape.
All right. What do you think, Discord?
That seems like a good place to put it for me. I was actually expecting to get it pushed lower, though Xerxes hasn't talked yet, so that may change. So yeah, I'm okay with that place.
All right, Boxman, what do you think?
Okay, let me take a look at where that is.
That's number
really,
63.
Really freaking high. 63 for Banjo-Kazooie? I don't know, man.
Well, we get a lot of platformers around
I know,
somehow.
I have my consolation rank for that.
All right, let me look at this. Because that is really like, that's like saying that, look, anything in the top 100 at this point, because right now we've got about, it's a very top-heavy list or top-heavy, bottom-heavy. There's not a lot of mediocre games.
Oh, wait. I also got two creations of the weighted Megaman Legends solo. So I'm going to have to put that in my vote down the photo.
Okay. I actually came with a much more reasonable range I wasn't expecting. Because I was looking towards the 130, because we already have a bunch of N64 games. And I don't know if I would put it better than the first Sin and Punishment. Maybe comparable to Goemon's Great Adventure down at 121.
That would be about the middle of the list. So, you know, it's that, which in our list is actually really good because it's a very, like, the games in, like, the top 100 are, for the most part, exceptional. It's just because people nominate games that they either really, really like or really, really hate. And usually those are games that are really good or really bad. I do want to put it above. Yeah, Goemon's Great Adventure. That's the second N64 one, right?
I would put it above.
Is that the first? I thought that was the first.
No, that's Legend of the Mystical Ninja, right?
Okay. I think you're right.
Or is it Mystical Ninja starring Goemon? I don't know. But that's the one with the springtime dancing and all that stuff. And the Peach Mountain Shoguns. I mean, that would be. I would rank that higher than Banjo Kazooie just for the zaniness factor alone. But we're not talking about that one.
I had a lot more fun playing Banjo-Kazooie, though.
Are you kidding me? Really, you got, like, the hammer that turns everything into meat that is itself like a giant ham hock? I mean, that is awesome. You got Plasma Man. Plasma Man versus Bumbo. I mean, there's no question. Plasma Man smokes Bumbo.
Goemon has all those town segments that are really, really slow down the game that I just don't want to do at all.
Yeah, I checked, and this is the second one, which was a 2D side-scrolling in the style of the SNES ones.
Yeah. So I got to put Banjo-Kazooie, like, I would say, I mean, we got, like, Sin and Punishment is at 102.
Right. I don't think I could put it above that. I like Sin and Punishment more than Banjo-Kazooie.
I think I could say, like, I like it better than, like, see, I don't, like, Sinistar, Quirk, Rampart, UN Squadron. You see what I mean about these games? Like, these are, I mean, Dynamite Cop, I could put it above that. I could put it above Capcom versus SNK2. I can even put it above MVC2, but below Bangaio. Because above Bangaio is like Street Fighter 3, Third Strike, which is really, really good.
Between Bangaio and Marvel's Capcom 2?
Yeah, I could put it above MVC2, yeah. Because MVC2 is a mess. Okay. It's just like a glorious mess, but this is a much more competent game. And if you want to go back to this time period and experience like third person platformer kind of adventure type games, like, this is a good example. It's not so above the curve that it's not representative of its time and its genre. It's very much like, this is a good example of what this kind of thing was. And especially for the N64, which is like a console that has a lot more nostalgia than it has good games that are worth revisiting. You know what I mean? Like, I love the N64 for some reason, but when I go back, like, let's play some N64 games, it's like, ugh. It's a real garbage dump. Like, look at this crap. You know, it's like, and this is a game that I would go back and play. Like, I was playing it a couple, actually about 20 minutes ago to get ready for this. Not 20 minutes ago, about 50 minutes ago to get ready for this episode. And I was having an okay time. I wasn't miserable.
Right, so it sounds like we're mostly agreed.
Yeah.
Is that okay? I mean, that's way lower than the 60s, but I feel like it's...
That was higher than I thought it would be. I have from talks about Gondis, I thought I would like have to like fight to like get above like Riven or something.
No, I wouldn't. I'm not a monster. I'm not a monster, Discord.
We would literally die.
No, I mean, like, compared to, like, say, Banjo-Kazooie 2, like, is it superior to that one or not?
I would say in some ways, yes, because Banjo-Tooie is really, really big, almost to, maybe somewhat to its detriment, really.
I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure. Like, less than Donkey Kong 64, like, I feel partway through development, they look at some of the backlash of Donkey Kong 64 and trimmed down some of the stuff, but it still has a bunch of stuff. It has like a first person mode. I don't know why it needs that. It has a bunch of GGs that require you going between multiple different worlds, which again is cool in theory, but like can be very confusing when before you understand the game.
Yeah. I mean, and this game also has some interesting, not firsts exactly. There are games that did this before it, but for the platform, I mean, the music thing I think is not a huge deal, but it's really worth considering. Because it's cool. Like when you play it, you notice. Like you're like, oh, that's cool. Like I go to the ant section of the first world, and like they change. You know, they start adding a different element to the song, and it's neat. Like, and it's a good way of like breaking up the kind of so worlds into like specific areas. It helps you mentally like sort out where everything is because you're like, oh yeah, this is where the song changes and has this thing. Which is a cool and well implemented idea. So I think I think we can live with that rating, it sounds like. So
yeah.
Banjo-Kazooie goes right above Marvel vs. Capcom 2 and right below, I lost my place in the list, right below Bangaio for the Dreamcast. So I hope all you collect-a-thon platformer fans are happy because that's a pretty high ranking.
Hello everyone, Jeff the Electric Viking here. You might remember me as the biggest Super Scalar fan in the world, or perhaps as the resident Bad at Games guy. Nevertheless, I've had the good fortune of working with the HD101 gang for over a year now, and I have a stake in seeing the outfit continue to move from strength to strength, and that's where you come in. I would humbly ask that you consider a small monthly contribution to HD101 on Patreon. Your money funds paid writing on the video games that you love, helps fund this show, and on top of that, you'll gain access to an add-on version of the HD101 podcast, with bonus content every week. All of this can be had for the price of a coffee, beer, or whatever the hell it is you drink in your corner of the world. Thanks for your consideration. And remember, be sure to have your pets spayed or neutered.
Xerxes had to step out for a moment, so I'm going to be introducing Silent Bomber, which was nominated to us by at X6800, which I guess that's actually a somewhat appropriate name for someone who would nominate this interesting bit of a PlayStation 1 anomaly. It was developed by CyberConnect, which is a name that I barely know, but they made a couple of good games. It was published by Bandai in the US and Japan, and Studio 3 in Europe PAL locations, which is interesting because, yeah, I just remember seeing Studio 3 in the intro for the game. Its earliest release date and territory was October 28th, 1999 in Japan, which makes it a pretty late PlayStation release at this point, because that was, what, like, just around when the Dreamcast came out, they released this one, so that's kind of cool. And in this game, you play as the stern and stalwart, emotionless, but actually has a bunch of emotions the whole time, Yuta, who is the titular Silent Bomber, I guess, although I don't know what that means, because
I want to say real quick that name is spelled with a J. The J is silent, but it is not... It looks like the state, but...
Yeah.
Don't forget the J.
It's pronounced Yuta, but I think that's just because in Japanese it would also kind of sound mostly the same. And yeah, so he blows things up, and his goal is to, he's been arrested for war crimes, I think, and he has to stop a giant battleship called the Dante, no relation to the giant sword-wielding crazy person. And he goes through this ship with a team of misfits and who are also prisoners. I'm explaining things that are basically not actually mentioned in the game. This is all in the manual. Don't try and find this in the game. It's all there in the manual. Very, very anime sort of stuff going on. And he blows his way up through a ship and then the game ends. And that's pretty much the game. So
basically, this is like a 90s action OVA the game. It's like pretty much all of those really cool video store exclusive anime releases in game form. You've got your stoic protagonist, you've got your supporting cast that barely does anything.
Yeah, this definitely, I mean, look, this game's from Bandai, and so Bandai were pretty good, and still are pretty good at anime, and it really, really shows this game is...
This is by CyberConnect, who is also known for the games like the Dot Hack series, the Little Tail Blunt meta series, which includes Tail Concerto and Solito Robo, as well as titles like Azure's Wrath and the recent Naruto fighting games. And one thing about them that's always been consistent is that they have a major cinematic flair to their titles.
Yeah, it really shows up. I'm convinced they got extra production values from the publisher, because there's some stuff that's... there's a lot of stuff in this that makes me think that they were planning to make this a pretty big franchise, and it didn't go off for whatever reason.
That's what I was thinking. If there's anyone who had the money to do that or the urge, it would be Bandai.
One loading graphical thing that kind of amazed me that I just want to get out of the way is that the cutscene quality polygon models actually have individual fingers, despite this being a PlayStation title.
Right, the 3D renders or the in-game?
The in the cutscenes that use the in-game engine, the character models actually have have individual fingers.
There's a lot of little details in here which you can sort of allude to a higher production value, like the all of the characters talking is kind of lip-synced. It's not quite, but they do a decent job of actually lip-syncing and blinking.
Yeah, the face aren't quite as good as Mega Man Legends, but the models, I would say, are quite a bit better.
I'd say it's a pretty good-looking game overall, still. I mean...
Let's get down to business here. This is, like, the prototype of the spectacle fighters, like, or character action games like Devil May Cry and such, with pretty much the exact same mission structure. Focus on getting high scores and winks, combo mechanics... And it's just an incredible overlooked action title for the PlayStation.
It annoys me so hard that this game is obscure as it is, because you think it'd be the kind of game that everybody brings up all the time talking about PlayStation, like, say, Vandal Hearts.
Yeah, so
but it's not. People don't talk about this game.
I own this game. I finished it back in 2001 or 2002, somewhere around there. But I actually tried to emulate this for this playthrough because I couldn't be bothered to get my system out. But it crashed partway through. Where I'm going with this is I looked up Let's Plays and stuff, and there's not, you know, a very high density of people Let's Playing this game. There's like a few videos of, you know, a couple of playthroughs that have not got very many views, which is interesting because it's like the exact thing that you would expect serious LPers to be interested in. It's mission-based structure. It's got lots of stuff to do. It's all rank and score and time-based. There's so much going on, and it's a butter smooth game to play. Everything in this game, it really performs at a level that you wouldn't expect. This game has like explosions and stuff as you would expect, and it maintains a pretty solid frame rate until you like really crank it out in certain levels where, you know, you've got, you know, a bunch of stuff breaking all at the same time. Otherwise it runs really fast. So we should probably explain how the main character plays though, because it's called Silent Bomber. And he does not run around with a sword or guns. He runs around and just kind of flings bombs at things, which is...
Yeah, you're armed with these customizable gauntlets called E-units that allow you to either place bombs where you're currently standing or lock on and or fire them, with optionally locking onto enemies first.
And you will lock on a lot. It's often a pretty important technique.
And One thing that I really appreciate is the use of a fixed top-down perspective for much of the action, instead of a disorienting 3D camera.
It's basically the same kind of camera as Metal Gear Solid. It does work pretty well.
Yeah, there's no guesswork for the what little platforming there is, or trying to figure out where you are in relation to enemies. It's all really clear, which I appreciate for an action title.
Well, because the camera is basically handcrafted depending on which area of the game you're in. Like, it just, the camera is deliberately chosen to be in certain places. Also, it's used quite dramatically, because sometimes in some of the boss fights and stuff, the camera will focus on enemies that are moving around as opposed to sitting in a fixed location. Which, it ends, this game has a lot of, again, yeah, it does have a strong cinematic flair between the intermissions where characters talk to each other, but, you know, they do stuff that's a little bit, you know, a little bit more dramatic, like characters will be sitting down, lying down, walking around the environment and talking. There's none of that PlayStation and N64 era sort of characters enter the room and then they face each other and then they talk and then they walk out. It actually is camera positioning and characters gesticulating and stuff. And it's pretty cool. And there's like environmental sounds and stuff going on in the cutscenes. It's a fun ride to play through. And also, the main character murders a bunch of innocent people in the tutorial, which is always
fun. The tutorial is all made me think a lot of the later, the infamous white phosphorus scene from Spec Ops The Line.
Yeah, this game gets dark really fast.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of surprised at how messed up the corpses are when the few you actually see lying around.
There's like screams of dying children being suddenly cut off. That is twisted.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's
really
to set the scene for the character.
Yeah, they really wanted to sell you on just how traumatized Utah was.
And yeah, it's interesting, and the cast of characters in the game is pretty good. You know, I know someone here likes one of the idiot characters for no reason. I have no idea, but
that's me. His name is Tim, and every single line he delivers is delivered in the whiniest possible tone. And it just cracks me up because he just sounds so whiny and incompetent, and I don't know how anyone stands him, but I just love listening to him just because of that.
Reading the manual is some explanation for that. He's not a trained military pilot.
Well, no
he's
one is
actually
super military.
He's actually a convict who apparently helped criminals escape from prison before he was like jailed and press ganged into this mission.
And the way he tells, like, "We're getting wiped out by the enemy, John."
That's very close to what he sounds like. That's a good imitation.
I was a little more fiction a little bit, because the only character I can think of that Utah reminds me of is Hiro Yui from Gundam Wing, only a lot more effective at what he does.
Never questioned his efficiency in this game, which helps to empower you as the player. Like, it's like, go blow up everything. Okay, I'm gonna go blow up everything. And then he blows up everything. That's every cutscene.
The whole mission accepted kind of dialogue quirk.
I like him. I like that the one of the other characters is basically just like a slutty like girl. Like, she does, that's like, she has no purpose
like
in this mission.
She's like this budget version of Fujiko from Lupin the Third.
Like, it's so stupid. It's like, why did they send her on this mission? Like, they're
yeah,
all being gang pressed from being convicts, but
yeah, that's not where the manual actually clarifies things that sadly didn't make it into the game. She's actually apparently a government spy. Like, one of the only ones who isn't a convict that was sent on this mission.
She's a government spy that wears one of those, like, G-string leotards. That's a very common trope for this period of time, but it just looks so ridiculous. I like that the main lady, Unri, is dressed in a almost practical fashion and wears some sort of beret/potato on her head.
Yeah, that's the only character who's officially involved in the military, apparently.
It's a fun cast, and the game is very fun for what it does, and what I like about the game as a game, in terms of how it plays, it feels extremely confident about what it wants you to do. It's really surprising to me how, like, well put together the game is, because I don't really... The only game that has the mechanics that like this one that I can really think of is Bomberman. Like, that's the only game where you throw bombs and you plant bombs, and this game...
This game is the gritty reboot of Bomberman that should have existed.
Right, like, it's crazy.
The only issue I have with Controls is that I kind of wish there was a separate shoot bomb button for Murder Lock-On.
Right, so the game's kind of balanced around it, but you have to hold the drop bomb button for about, would you say, like 0.75 seconds to trigger the lock-on?
Less than a second. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, so...
And then you have to, which creates this holographic targeting reticle, and then you have to release the button again to fire a bomb, and if you press the button again fast enough, the reticle sticks around, and you can keep shooting them in rapid succession.
As long as they don't get too far away from you. But it all works together really well. It does kind of all clink.
The one thing I kind of wish would have been a fire bomb button in addition to having the reticle out. Since sometimes the mechanic feels a little clunky, but other than that, it plays really smooth for a PlayStation title.
Yeah, I'd say annoying aspect was if you get hit by something, and you don't get hit a lot, but you can get blown up by your own bombs or running into enemies and stuff, your lock-on is just killed. And so you kind of fall on the ground, and then you gets back up, and you have to re-hold down the lock-on button, essentially, to trigger lock-on again. And that can take a couple of seconds, so it can be a little annoying occasionally when the game gets tougher.
I'd say if this game came out just a little bit later, it would have been like a twin stick game. That seems like it would be a good way to control this sort of game.
Well, the thing is, I actually like the way that you kind of play it. I think that it's fortunate that it came out before it would have made an artificial use of the right stick. I think that it kind of is interesting the way Yuta can't just kind of casually fling bombs all around him, and instead you kind of have to do a little bit of kind of risk reward where you have to face the enemy to lock on, and then you jump, and then you use your double jump, which in this game is an air dash, which is really cool, and I love air dashing, and it's really fun. And you can also, you almost never have to do this, but Yuta can also jump off walls. I think you use it like once or twice in the whole game, but you can do it, and it's kind of, it adds this like feeling of like Yuta's actually pretty mobile as a character, which is, again, pretty cool.
I also think that the air dash itself is kind of a risk-reward thing, because it actually has recovery frames on landing, which both sells it as being really fast and actually taking some kind of toll.
Right, and yeah, so
it's not just like you're completely weightless.
The other cool thing is you get a couple of extra bombs that round out your arsenal, so to speak, because you get you can't fling these at enemies. You have to plant these on the ground. And they are firebomb, sort of like EMP, electric bomb, and a gravitational black hole bomb. And the latter two don't hurt Yuta in any way. So they give you some means to kind of manipulate enemies. And you can blow up projectiles and dodge and absorb projectiles in this game with explosions and stuff. So there's even things like that going on.
The napalm's really useful against the bioweapons later on the game that you can't lock on to.
Yeah, those are cool because, again, the game... that's the thing that I love about this game is they knew the mechanics that they were giving you, and so the game is really built around using those mechanics in interesting and diverse ways, which makes this game, to me, most of the time, it feels very much like a treasure game, which I'm giving this as very high praise to it.
Yeah, I think it's not the same. It's just so competently put together. It's almost scary.
It feels like a game that's more recent than it is. It feels, I want to say, almost ahead of its time.
I think that you should say it's ahead of its time, because I don't know what you'd compare it to. It's also quite generous in ways that I think a lot of other games weren't. There's no life system. Instead, you just can continue indefinitely. It knocks your score down to zero for that mission. But the only thing your score actually does in this game is unlock... you get rankings, but all it does is unlock some multiplayer characters. And you get upgrades in this game, which encourage you to explore the environment, but all they are is a little, like, essentially a stat point kind of chips, and you can choose whether to put them into more bombs, more shield, or longer range. And the crazy thing is, you can just change them. You can choose whatever you want. And I think you can even change it in real time if you feel like it, if you pause the game and navigate to the menu.
Yeah, which you can do them anytime you want just by pausing and then pressing select.
Which is really, like, wow, you can kind of feel like, you know, I gotta raise my shielding to keep my health up, and then this boss, I need longer range, so I'm gonna change that. And by making you pause it, it doesn't, you know, it's kind of like you're not supposed to just constantly do that. And so, you know, it's good, and the game doesn't, you don't need to engage with that, but the fact that you have a lot of generosity in this game, And I think either when you finish the game or at any time, you can actually go back to previous missions to collect more stuff. So that's cool, too. And
if you actually get A-Wings on every level, you even unlock a maxed out version. This is not enough E-chips in the game to fully match.
The ranking system kind of annoyed me because I never figured out what you had to do to get the best rankings.
From my experience in the later, shorter levels, it seems like time is the most important thing.
I would say that the two most important things are time and not taking much damage, because you get quite a big bonus for not taking much damage. But, you know, the rankings are not super important. It really, it doesn't matter. But it is there because the game is a little short.
I'd say playthrough will probably last you about 2 hours. But it doesn't really feel that short, is the weird thing. It draws so many different set pieces over the course of it that it's kind of like some of the older arcade titles, and the action titles in that regard.
Right, it definitely leans more towards something like, not Shinobi, come on, I'll get there. Strider. It definitely is a little bit more leaning towards something like Strider, where the game is just, here's new stuff, here's more stuff. And you're like, cool, cool, cool. And then the game ends, you're like, damn, it's over! There's no more game! And that's when you can go back and try and get your scores up and that sort of thing. And then you can dick around in the multiplayer. I mean,
you can play it against the AI. I think you can even pit the AI against each other and just watch.
Yeah, which is, it's a nice touch because the similar to Zone of the Enders, the multiplayer lets you play as pretty much the entire cast of characters that you would actually want to play as in a little like dueling arena. That includes most of the game's bosses, most of the more sort of versatile mooks that you come up against.
Yeah, the game plays those cool flying robot suits.
Yeah, and if you get all A or all S ranks, I think it's all S ranks if that's possible, you unlock the Tail Concerto mech, who's literally just there in the multiplayer if you manage to achieve that particularly difficult task. But
also, I want to say one last thing on the cutscenes I appreciate is the fact that they never go on too long to really break the flow of the game.
Yeah, because I think you can skip them too if you replay a stage. You can just hit start and you'll
They just
going.
Point you at what you need to do, give some exposition, and then just let you go on your way. Also,
there's a couple of mid-game CG cutscenes as well. This is an expensive game in that regard. Very few PlayStation games would do more than the intro CG screen, but nope, this one has a couple of midpoint screens in it, which is also fun. I think we have to move on to ranking this one. I don't think we can talk too much more about it, if anyone else has anything to say, but
my only regret is that it wasn't more influential than it is, and just sort of accidentally seems to resemble Devil May Cry. Yeah, in some ways.
Would round Ikaruga and Ranger X be too low? Because that's what this game kind of reminds me of.
My first instinct is somewhere around Space Harrier, I think.
Yeah, I mean, those are, like, this is a very difficult one to place, I think. Because it doesn't
have... It is a great game, but no one bought it.
I bought this game. I'll tell you where I bought it from. I'm not going to give you the exact details, but I bought this from a country town video rental store in country Australia. Like, that's where I found this copy of this game. I had never seen a copy of this game outside of that one... just completely like under 10,000 people in this town video store, and I bought it from them. So I think the distribution for this game was horrible.
Yeah, I remember having to hunt it down myself at a really far out GameStop from where I live.
Also, we can't show you because this is a voice recording and we're probably not going to edit it into the video, but it has some of the worst magazine advertisements I have ever seen. I want to thank Gunhart for linking us to those to show us how ridiculous they are.
It's just scantily clad models holding the logo.
Yeah, and you never see that in 90s advertising, do you?
Even the Death Trap Dungeons ads told you more about the game.
Yeah, I didn't even show you the graphics or anything. Like, what a poor game. I think this game, yes.
And there's just no excuse because, like, I mean, it was released right around the anime boom in the first place, so...
If they had crammed all the anime art into an ad and pushed that angle, it probably would have done a little better. I mean... It's also got some good, nice bouncy music. I like it.
So,
see, we can move this higher up. I say deserves it.
Yeah. I definitely liked it more than Organ Trail a lot.
Is it high? Should it go higher than Space Harrier, though?
Yeah, I think it can go higher.
So this higher is, we've, we've been given the keys to the list here, because our overlord and regulator, Xerxes, is not here. So every time he's not here, I tend to put something really stupid really high, and it's going to happen again, I think, because I want this
game. I say we put above Bejeweled. This game deserved better than it's got.
I mean, that's the question about Silent Bomber. If there was a game that we have looked at so far, this game is up there as one of the most, like, signal flare this game. Like, check out this game, because you will be like, what? Why is this game on the PlayStation? And why is it not kind of constantly in top 10, top 20 PlayStation games list? Because it's a PlayStation exclusive.
I'm going to get really greedy on this one. What about between Earthbound and Bionic Commando?
Yeah, they're going to cut me for this one. They're going to be like...
Devil May Cry and Earthbound.
I think that I do have to draw the line at some point in terms of, unfortunately, this game just didn't have that influence that it kind of needs to breach the very upper
Sort of region. Then Bloodborne and Bionic Commando.
I'm going to let Bob say what he's trying to think of. I think he's the least.
I was going to say between Alien Soldier and Streets of Rage 2, but we can go a bit higher.
I was going to say I kind of want it above Bejeweled if we can.
Because I was looking, we got kind of 29, because we haven't been throwing out the numbers here, because we crawled quite high up the list. 29 is Final Fantasy VII. And
better than Final Fantasy VII, I can say that.
Okay, see, you've just... There you go. Like, it's better than Final... I mean, Final Fantasy VII was also
I'd rather play this in Adventure. Definitely rather play this in Metroid. Realdozer?
Realdozer's kind of slow for me.
I think in this general range, I don't know if I can put it above Bejeweled, because Bejeweled just kind of... It's like, this is the most opposite of Bejeweled a game could physically be, probably. But Bejeweled important.
I would definitely draw the line at the Donkey Kong for Game Boy.
Yeah, I mean...
How about between Bejeweled and Mario Land 4?
I think that is probably the fairest place I can give this without getting in a huge amount of... people being like, what is that? Why is that that high? I think that we can get away with that.
I'll figure it out and ding us for it.
But no, I think 22, 23, between those. So I would put it at 23 above Mario Land 4. I think that's a fair place for this game, because I don't think I've ever played a game quite like Silent Bomber, because it isn't, no one's replicated this exact formula. But also a game that is so astoundingly ahead of its time. Like, there's no reason that this game should have come out in 1999, as far as I could tell. Like, it, you compare it to its contemporary PlayStation action games, they got nothing on this game. Like, none of them.
I think you could have released this game like 1 year later, maybe two even, around 2001, and it was still
done okay. Next fan that I am, I think it's actually the best made game ever.
My goodness, that is high praise. I mean, I do have to say that I can't put it higher than that, simply because, unfortunately, like Devil May Cry and other games, like this game was unfairly overlooked, and then they came along and they set the standard, and that happens in games sometimes. Sometimes something is just really impressive, and nobody played it apparently, which is crazy. And maybe it should have had a better name. Maybe it should have just been called something else, because I think people thought this was going to be a Metal Gear Solid clone, and they went, nah, that's stupid. I'm not playing that. And it wasn't, and it didn't. But I'm going to put it below Bejeweled, between above Wario Land 4, unless there are any substantial objections.
Good enough for me.
All right, sweet. It's our new number 23, and may YouTube have mercy on us all.
In about 2 years.
I'm making those.
We're working on it.
Wow, what a enthralling, what's an adjective I haven't used yet? Oh, incredible. What an incredible conversation that was. Those are really two amazing games that we talked about there. But guess what? We kept going. That's right. We talked about a really incredible game, a truly incredible game, The Incredible Toon Machine, which is a PC puzzle game. It's, I guess, a sequel to The Incredible Machine. And it's pretty cool. So that's just one of the many Patreon bonus game rankings that you get by being a patron at patreon.com/HG101. You go there, you donate a minimum of $2 a month, and you will get access to that game and all the other bonus rankings we've done, which are quite a few. And they make up some pretty important little spots on our list there. So it's definitely worth checking out. It's definitely worth a little bit of your money. And it goes a long way. It helps pay for the HG101 website. It pays the writers who write for it. It pays the writers who write for the books, and it kicks a little bit back, kind of a gratuity to all of us who work on the show. So that's all for this episode of Hardcore Gaming 101's Top Games Podcast. Special thanks goes out to Sonic Blast Yoshi on iTunes and at X68000 on Twitter. That is, somebody picked a cherry Twitter handle there. That can't be right. Is that right? That's awesome.
No, good, that's right. That's what it
good
said.
On you, man. Or ma'am. Or... thank you for nominating those games, and thanks to those of you we haven't gotten to yet. We're hoping to get to you as soon as we can. And thanks to my lovely co-host and compatriots, and thanks to our editor Jeff Rude, and our theme song composer Mateki, and our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter Bob Nader. And of course, thank you, listeners, for your support and feedback. Support and feedback, you say? Yes, support and feedback. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101. I know I did. And you can help us out by subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel and by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. But you can also hang out with us in our Discord. And you can also hang out with us at our Discord channel. It's at bit.ly/HG Discord. But most importantly, help us claw our way into the podcasting firmament by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a sweet 5-star review. Do it, or we'll have a useless space pilot constantly follow you around, whining directly into your eardrums. Until next week, keep keeping it real.